Hello, welcome to, I think this is episode 4 now of Steeped in History. I'm Jimmy, and today we have an absolute treat for you. It's another lovely episode with a guest. This week's guest is Michael Mulcher, and I'll introduce Mike soon. But just by way of warning, I'm still pretty new to this podcasting lark, and you will notice that there are some audio issues here. My wonderful friend Hrithian, who has his own podcast about D&D, which I will link to in the description, has helped me with the audio. So diolch Hrid. I've tried my best to salvage the audio as best I can, but there are some bits where me and Mike are talking at the same time where you will hear a bit of reverb in my voice, and I just could not get rid of that. So please do try and fight your way through the bits where I'm talking as best you can. Mike is the one who is the star of the show for this episode. He is a fantastic bloke. He's got so much knowledge, and he's a really entertaining man to listen to. So enjoy my brilliant conversation with Mike, and apologies to Catherine because I kept Mike on the recording for so long that he forgot to make dinner. So enjoy episode 4. Welcome. Welcome to whatever episode of Steeped in History this is, and welcome to my special guest for this episode. He is a best-selling author. He is he is an author, and he's sold books.
I've sold one or two, yeah.
You've sold one or two. He is an esteemed PR droid to Tharg the Mighty. And he is an historical reenactor par excellence. He is Michael Mulcher. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Hello. I'm well, thank you. Jimmy, how are you?
I'm here, and I definitely didn't get locked out of my flat for 20 minutes delaying our meeting up.
Marvellous. Marvellous.
It's going really well. I'm good at podcasting. There's pepper on that finger, and I've just put it in my eye. That really hurts. Drock. So, I wanted you to do a podcast as well. I forgot you also do the 2080 Thrillcast, which is an amazing podcast, which everybody should listen to because it's very good and has a very interesting insights into... Well, it's not just 2080, is it? It's sort of comics as an art form in general a lot of the time.
Comics as an art form, storytelling, a little bit of politics. I tend to sneak... I got a wonderful text off a friend the other day after they'd listened to a recent episode where they said they were mocking me and went, please allow me to interrupt to use my comics podcast in order to tell you about the two words from the Czech language that have come over to English. Which I had done, but he was like, this is so very much you doing that.
That's cool. I want to know what the words are now.
Robot and pistol.
Really? That's cool.
Yeah, robot comes via R-U-R, which was a play by a guy called Karol Čapek. In the 1920s, which is about basically a robot uprising. The word robot in Czech kind of translates as servant / slave. So that was the general point of the play. And it was translated into English, but the word robot had no equivalent. So yeah, robot and pistol for some... I don't know why pistol, but yeah. So these are the fascinating facts one can find out by tuning into the 2080 Thrillcast.
Everybody listen to the 2080 Thrillcast, available now on all good podcatchers. It's dumb. I love it. I knew it was going to be daft, and I'm so glad. I forgot to say the name of your book, but your book is called I Am the Law, How Judge Dredd Predicted Our Future, and it's really bloody good, actually.
Thank you.
It's a really good book, actually. You've probably had to do this loads of times, but have you got an elevator pitch to tell people what the book's about in case they haven't read it yet?
So, how did a 1970s children's comic predict the rise of authoritarian fascism in the 21st century via the medium of a futuristic cop who is judge, jury, and executioner on the streets of Mega City One in a future America? And so it touches on everything from the militarization of policing, the history of policing, modes of governance, philosophy, politics, and how neoliberal, the essential neoliberal coup that took place in the 1970s remade the world into an image of law and order, which are the three words that have actually defined the last 50 years of human experience. So, yes, that's it. It's it did very well. I'm very proud of it. I have to just keep putting myself to not kind of naturally go, oh no, but it's just a silly book. Yeah, it's done all right.
It's not a silly little book. It is a book. I tried to write a book and my brain broke. So
you should be very proud of your brain broke
multiple times. It was 2 years of absolute hell because apparently my mind. Apparently we're not meant to self-diagnose anymore. My mind clearly kind of went, you've probably got some form of quite unpleasant neurodivergence, Michael, because I'm going to ensure that you have to do this as perfectly as you can, but I'm going to stand in your way at every single step.
You need to write a book today. Ooh, look, washing up.
I won't go into it too much because it was also lockdown the first 2 years of the pandemic. I was having to do my day job as well, which actually it was one of those jobs because I work effectively in the kind of entertainment industry.
Yeah, yeah. For anyone who didn't get the reference at the start, Mike also works for 2000 AD. Which is I would say a sort of at this stage a veteran publisher in comic book terms, certainly.
Legendary is the word, isn't it? Yeah, a galactic powerhouse of comic book publishing.
Yeah, well, it's the 50th anniversary in less than 2 years now.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, so during lockdown, obviously people started consuming a lot more media than they had been doing previously. So while most of the comic book industry closed down because it was based around the need for brick and mortar comic book stores that people could go to, we have a substantial subscriber base. So we kept going. And if anything, things became busier. So I was doing all of that. I'd do a full day's work and then go downstairs, have my dinner with my wife, watch half an hour of TV, and basically walk up the stairs of my house to what is now my study, like Jacob Bloody Marley, covered in chains. Just like, oh, and then there'd be the kind of regulation 3 hours of procrastination before midnight, and I just kind of then try and crack up. So it was awful, and I have promised my wife that if I ever try to write another one, we'll have a big long conversation about me going on some form of drugs before doing it.
You'll have to get your brain medicine before you write another book.
I definitely feel that.
Well, it's a bloody good book, so if anybody hasn't read it, now you don't have an excuse, because it's really, really, really good. I must get mine signed by you at some point.
Genuinely love you to do signing. Like, normally I'm organising signings, so it was actually nice to be on the other side of it. But then last year, a very good friend of mine called Ed, who's in my reenactment group. We were at an event in Deepest Darkest Oxfordshire, and he...
Was that Cropperty?
So I said, oh... yes, it was Cropperty right, Bridge, yeah. And he said, oh, come, you know, I need you to come over here. And I sort of came around the corner of my tent, and he'd set up like a picnic table so I could do a signing for him. And it was just because he couldn't make it to the lead signing. It was like the sweetest thing. I was like, oh, this is so lovely. Like, it's good to do this book. So that was, yeah, that was very nice. So, yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, we didn't mention, well, I mean, I touched on it, but you are again, also a reenactor, a fellow reenactor, and you reenact the Civil Wars, our Civil Wars, rather than the American Civil Wars, which I think a lot of listeners, that will be their Civil War that they're familiar with, but you're a 17th century reenactor.
Yes, yes, the original Civil War, and indeed, if one is to be controversial, one can trot out the idea that the American Civil War is just one stage of the English Civil War that began in, the Wars of the Three Kingdoms that began in 1638 in Scotland, and go all the way through the American War of Independence and the American Civil War through to the Civil Rights era. People often talk about the long 19th century or the long 18th century. I like, but realize the flaws of the idea that actually the English Civil War kind of started at the Reformation and finished, if that's the right word, in the 1960s, but I don't think so.
I like that. I think your controversial opinion is excellent. Yeah, that's arguable. That's really arguable. I can definitely see how, you know, oh, I guess like the Seven Years' War is an extension of some of the issues that were still prevalent after. No, I can see it continuing, and of course the sectarianism never stopped. And yeah, 100%. Oh, damn, I'm in now.
Well, I mean, my wife and I went to Northern Ireland last year, and. One of the things that was really striking, and you know, absolutely, when you're English, when you've never been to Northern Ireland, the most sectarianism you will ever experience in your life is if you happen to live in or visit Glasgow or Liverpool at a particular time of the year when the Orange Men march, and normally, when talking about a group, I would apologise if I cause offence, but I'm not going to, because the Orange Order is just an awful organisation. So you see them march and you go, well, those people are ridiculous and this is sectarian and this is awful. And then you go to Northern Ireland and realise that your experience of sectarianism is just like a child's primary school understanding. Even if you know the history, you don't really know the history. And we were driving to I'd been on a holiday for a couple of days with some friends at Ballycastle, which is
that's where I'm from.
Friend.
Yeah,
I'd is from. I always send him a picture of whatever pub I'm in. In that neck of the woods, and he goes, I had my 18th birthday in there. I had my but we drove from Ballycastle to Derry. And you know you're in a unionist area because all the flags appear on the lamppost, and of course one of those flags is King Billy's standard, which is very, very similar to the flags that we use when we reenact the Civil Wars. You know, you've got the field of a single primary colour, of a colour. You've got the St. George's flag in the corner, and then you've got a device, in this case, a star in the centre. And it just, not that I necessarily needed reminding, because a significant chunk of my book is about Ireland as what I and others have described as the imperial crucible. So all the techniques that the Empire used around the world, it first tested in Ireland. But it was shocking to see that imagery that so connects my reenactment period with that, you know,
It's weird, I think, as well, seeing there's a real, or at least I think I find there's a sort of disconnect between speaking about the Orange Order. Also, it was called Tawny at the time he was alive. Not orange, that's not how it works. Also, not a word that they used to describe that colour. Anywho, and it was pronounced Orania.
Nerd.
Yeah, I know. You're on my podcast, man. Of course. I find it's really interesting to see the disconnect between the Orange Order and what they stand for, and the actual history. And William of Orange is partly funded by the Pope, right? So all of this depth and nuance of history that's about the history in Northern Ireland, Ireland more broadly, in that time period, and the tactics being used there is just gone. And now it's just pink men in bowler hats walking in time badly and just being awful people. I've been woken up by an Orange March once, and that was when I lived in Glasgow, and it was just awful. It took me a good while to realise what was going on, and I opened a window and went, oh no, racists. Grim.
I far be it for me to condemn anybody for celebrating the heritage, but there's heritage, and then there's a certain version of history. And what was really striking was when we went to Derry, we went to the Bloody Sunday Museum, which I hadn't realised how small Derry was. So This is a museum that literally is in the shadow of the walls, like the 17th, 18th century walls of Derry. Mm-hmm. Well, 16th century as well. And I mean, it's one of the most affecting museums I've ever been in. It's absolutely incredible. I encourage everybody to go and see it. And then we went to what is called the Siege of Derry Museum, which is inside the walls of Derry. Ooh. And is about 1689, in the Williamite War, when Derry was besieged.
Yes.
And they're going around it, and I'm like, this, you know, I'm not an expert on this history, but some of this feels like it's missing out some detail. And then we watched an audiovisual presentation where it went through it all and said, and the siege was lifted and religious freedom for all was preserved. And I went, what? That's not true. And then we went to the next floor and I was like, this is not the Siege of Derry Museum. This is the Apprentice Boys Museum.
Oh no!
Clearly, there'd been a rebranding at some point, but it was really striking. And you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people who listen to this who maybe have a real problem with it, and I don't really care in this regard, because it was more than just, this is a different perspective.
Yeah.
It was this is leaving stuff out. Really important stuff. You know, 300-400 years of Protestant hegemony.
Yeah.
In Northern Ireland. And even as somebody raised Methodist, you know, I was raised an English Protestant. And I was like, this is not correct. But it is really striking going around like the castles of Northern Ireland, how history effectively stops in about 1609.
Yeah, Yeah, and yeah, there's a distinct. I think there's a deeply uncomfortable, especially for two citizens of the UK, you know, born on mainland Great Britain. There's a really uncomfortable moment when you're talking about Ireland, when it really starts kicking in. Where you're like, is anything that I'm saying offensive or racist to anybody? But like, there's also an understandable element to it, right? This is a country that, I mean, it's only been, the Republic of Ireland has only been an independent country that escaped from the British Empire for a few generations, for a century. Like,
yes, it's totally.
You know, if you're talking about Ireland as it is currently constituted, we're only talking a century.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, I think it's understandable that time is being taken to like reconcile how you present history.
100%. And also, I think it's also vital. It's not just about the people in Northern Ireland. It's not just about Ireland as a whole. But also, it's about, for me, it's about challenging the preconceptions and notions that we have as Englishmen, Welshmen, Scotsmen, because the version of that history is uncomfortable, and we have been fed a certain version of it. And yeah, you know, there is a degree of self-analysis that one has to undertake, and but this is by no means a process that is concluded. I reenact a period of history that includes the invasion of Ireland, the Irish Rebellion, Cromwell's behavior. And not, I mean, as bad as Cromwell was, they were worse before him, and they were definitely worse after him. But nonetheless, it was Cromwell and Henry Ireton, the Earl of Strafford, of course, who was I think in a book I read recently, it described him as an effective governor of Ireland. I was like, that's a really loaded, like, from what perspective are you saying that he was effective?
Ooh, yeah.
So, you know, I know that at least one friend of mine who is Irish, bless them, they don't allow it to ruin our friendship, but you know, we don't talk about my reenactment. No. Because to them, I'm reenacting a Cromwellian, you know, and without reference to Ireland. Like, we rarely reenact the battles of the New Model Army. I think it's like,
no, that's true. Yeah,
maybe once every few years. And certainly nothing after sort of 1648. So we'll maybe have done, I think I've done like maybe two 1640, second English Civil War battles. But beyond that, nothing.
Well, I'm in a royalist regiment, so I'm fine.
Oh, au contraire, mon frère.
right? Ain't no, there are no good Englishmen, Mike, I know this. but it's tough. It's one of the things that reenactors have to contend with is there will be bad stuff about the period we're reenacting, probably perpetrated or perpetuated by the people you're reenacting. Like, the impression you're doing is going to be problematic, is the fashionable word at the moment, but the people that we're reenacting are bad people by today's standards. Probably, almost certainly, in some way or another, they've done things or thought things that today would be immoral, illegal, whatever it may be. And it's really tough, because we're kind of decent human beings. We just like the past, and we want people to not forget about it, and to understand it with depth, and understand the nuance present in the past. And the one that I think about a lot is anti-war protesters turning up to events and saying, oh, well, you're glorifying war. And we're really not. And a lot of the people involved are ex-service people with horrible experiences that they don't want other people to go through. We just like dressing up in old clothes and saying, hey, this is what Vikings look like. Look how little black leather I'm wearing.
Eyeliner, Jimmy. Eyeliner. Where's your eyeliner?
Oh, I'm always slathered in it, mate. I'm always slathered in it. But yeah, it's... Ooh, reenactment is complicated. Ooh, vicar is complicated.
I think one of the big misconceptions and where you kind of... In the great culture war of the 21st century, it's wrong to seed the ground with the idea that the past was barbarous and so therefore should be let off, because so much people's perceptions of the past is now we're civilized, but in the past they weren't. So we can't judge them by our standards. Yeah. And number one, we're not civilized. As indeed, even just the last 6 months, 2 years has ably proven. And obviously, well, I'm not saying that there's a break with the past or anything, but also that in the past there were people who were moral and right, and there was particularly in relation to the civil wars, there was horror at the idea of civil strife and the consequences of it. There was horror at what Cromwell did in Ireland. There's horror at what Prince Rupert did at Bolton and Birmingham.
Yeah.
What George Monk did in Aberdeen. That for me challenges that notion of, you know, dashing cavaliers and Darrow around. There's often this perception that the civil wars, because the civil wars weren't as bad as it was in the 30 Years' War that was happening concomitantly, that somehow it's not as bad.
Yeah, just because we don't have Jacques Callot engravings of dozens of people hanging from trees doesn't mean horrible atrocities weren't happening. Like Thomas Sandford boasting about killing children in Ireland to make garrisons surrender to him, for example.
Yeah.
Like all of this stuff.
There's also a reluctance in that we, unless you consume news, you're less likely to interact with things that are unpleasant.
Yeah, and it's weird that people will go to a reenactment of a battle, where if you went on the Wikipedia page, you would have a list of the casualties. So you're okay with it being, in a way, you're okay with it just being a statistic. You're not okay with it being challenging and confronting you with it, being confronted with what that history would have looked like. And I go as blood and guts as I can when I'm talking about Viking weapons on a living history camp. I'll be like, this is a bearded axe. Can you imagine this coming at you at speed and tearing your torso open? It would have been horrible. And the 7-year-old boys were always like, whoa, cool. And the like middle-aged white people are always like, Oh, I say. I thought you were a nice young man.
But yeah.
We do the whole thing about musket balls. Because they would mess you up good and proper.
Soft lead 60 caliber shot. Oof.
Yeah. Oh, and I hadn't realised. I thought it was a reenactorism. Now, for those who don't do reenactment who are listening to this, quite often there are things that creep into people's displays and things they learn from others, which are actually just either urban myths or just, you know, inaccuracies that just my least favorite one is X marks the spot, where people say, oh, it was because there's an X on the top of the pan of a musket. Where the match goes in, so you can aim it before you put. And there's no evidence of that whatsoever.
Yeah.
And the worst one is the bandoliers that we. Because I'm a musketeer now. I used to be a pikeman, but now I'm a musketeer. So the bandoliers, all the little flasks that we have around our body. People go, oh, they were called apostles because there were 12 of them. It's like there was no, they weren't. Like. Sometimes there's 15 of them. Sometimes there's 8. Like it just it really annoys me. Yeah. But I'd heard somebody talk about musketeers dipping their musket balls in cow dung. Not because they understood germ theory, but because, you know, they were farm workers. So if they got a cut and it got infected, it wasn't cow dung, but it was sulfuric acid, apparently.
What?
Yeah, am I just creating another reenactment? Is it? No, I'm pretty sure it was.
No, because we cannot. Acid. No, because we can't do that because we don't actually shoot musket balls at each other. So that's fine.
But yeah, it was just one of those moments where I was like, oh, that's a reenactmentism. And then I was reading something, and I think it's from the campaign in Ireland as well.
Oh, God, of course it is. Oh.
Where it was intended to make nasty. Anyway, we've got onto a very, very odd rabbit hole here.
Yeah, two reenactors brought together will inevitably start chatting about reenactment and entirely just divert from the format of the podcast, but it's fine. The full uncut version can go on the Patreon to encourage people to support me financially, and they can hear absolutely everything.
If you want to hear us rambling, then by all means sling some money Jimmy's way.
If you want rambling, I got rambling. Yeah. I'll ramble for money. We'll ramble for coin. Professional mitherer. I'm very good at it. The general format is we talk about what tea we're drinking, because I'm a mad tea drinker. But are you a tea drinker? Do you do the tea thing? What were you drinking when you were writing your book? Did you have like a work drink?
Yeah, so I don't drink coffee. I never have. The smell of it makes me ill. So I'm a big tea drinker. The thing that occurred with lockdown was I switched to loose leaf. Which I can't remember who it was. Somebody recommended switch to loose leaf, and I was like, oh yeah, no, it's just an affectation, you know, it's just it's a bit more expensive. And then I started getting the Yorkshire tea loose leaf.
Now we're talking.
And it tastes so much better than the tea bags.
It's as we speak, I have my mug of Violent Medieval Rabbits full of loose leaf Yorkshire Gold, splash of milk.
And I used to work at the newspaper in Harrogate.
Oh yes,
back when I was a reporter, and that's the home of tailors. Who do Yorkshire tea, and I'm not saying this is what tailors do, very important, but I was told by somebody that the stuff that gets into the tea bags is like at the end of the process, you know, it's like the dusty stuff.
The sweepings.
Yeah. I'm not maligning tailors in any way, shape or form. I know.
Yeah. They might want to sponsor me.
Tea bags just don't do it for me anymore. I'm very fortunate. I live in Oxford, we have a tea shop called Card Use, where you can get loose leaf, and I get green teas and jasmine teas and things like that from there. Ooh. But I always come back to Ooh. Yorkshire tea loose leaf.
Oh, Yorkshire tea loose leaf is a cracking choice. I'm proud to say that I'm drinking that right now. Right. There was a wonderful around the time of Brexit complaint that somebody made. I found out that they're importing their tea from India of all places. Why is it called Yorkshire tea if it's from India? Like, well, have you ever tried to grow tea in the Dales? go up to like Arkengarth Dale and try and grow some tea and see how that goes for you.
I mean, try growing anything, to be quite frank.
Anything other than sheep, try. Do your best. it's a really unironically really nice tea. It's just good, and it lasts for ages as well. You can definitely double cup. You can double pot.
Oh, yeah. I used to do that, and then I found the second cup started to taste a bit soapy.
Yeah, this is true.
But I mean, the thing is that I have this massive, like, 2/3 of a pint mug that kind of does. I've had to, in because I'm getting old, in the last sort of 18 months, I've had to stop having normal tea after about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And it came about because when I was writing my book, I realized that I was kind of getting to around about 8-9 o'clock at night, and I'd think, oh, I need to keep going for another few hours, and I will have had so much tea that I will be shaking and unable to sleep. But I can recommend Yorkshire Teas decaf options, which are also quite nice for. It's not too bad for decaf tea.
Yeah, some people rail against decaf, but it's pretty. It's like alcohol free beer. I think alcohol free Guinness is just as nice as normal Guinness.
If you have to be a designated driver, for example.
This is where we digress. So. I have tried 0% Guinness, and I did not care for it.
That's perfectly reasonable. It's perfectly fair.
However, I think it's because I'm a dark ale drinker, so I prefer my stouts and my porters and my milds. But the Erdinger 0% beers.
Ooh, yes, actually.
Now. Here's a tip. If you're a reenactor or any hobby that means you do a lot of aerobic exercise and then immediately go to the pub or start drinking, it's fantastic because it fools your body into thinking you're having a beer, and it's like an isotonic, it's a sports drink, and so you think. Your body thinks you're drinking, and actually you're rehydrating.
you're becoming, if anything, less drunk.
Yeah.
By drinking this beer. That's a genius tip. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's revolutionized my weekends. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's great. There's a really nice German one that tastes really malty. I can't remember what it's called now. I'll find out, but yeah. That's actually a really good tip. That's kind of what it's meant for. I'm sure one of the German alcohol-free beers advertises itself as like being used by the German Olympic shot put team. Drinks it when they're training.
It's probably something like Erdinger because it proudly on the label says isotonic drink.
It might be that then. It might be Erdinger. Oh, I love it. That's great. Oh yeah. I knew you were a man of taste. This is why I wanted to get you on the podcast because I knew that you were a gentleman after my own heart, Mike.
Necessity is the mother of invention, I think, with these things.
Isn't it just? Yes.
So have you got a year of interest that you'd like to share with people? And why is it in the 17th century? Have you got a year that you'd like to talk about? And why is it 1644?
Well, I mean, so I've been thinking, I'm really racking my brains because I'm aware that my choice will be Anglophilic and not necessarily a surprise. And it's 1642.
Excellent. That's perfectly fine. Yeah. You don't have to. There's no need to apologize at all.
Well, it's just, there are other contenders. Like there's can't remember for the life of me when it is. So one of the regicides, or two of the regicides, who were involved in the execution of Charles I in 1649. Mm. They fled to America, to the colonies.
Yeah.
And it was William Gough and what's his blessed name? Worley. I'm looking it up. I can't. Edward Worley. There we go. His father-in-law, Edward Worley. And they've been involved in the Regicide, and then were part of the rule of the Major Generals, which is when the Commonwealth became a fully fledged military dictatorship. And they fled to the Americas, specifically to Massachusetts. And there was most people won't know King Philip's War, which. A bit of a brutal but fascinating conflict. Basically, the English especially had outstayed their welcome, and had begun to expand. Do what the colonists did, which was to break agreements and treaties and expand into areas that they said they wouldn't.
Yeah,
and so there was a huge backlash by the indigenous population. In 1675 or 1676, William Gough was hiding in the area of a place called Hadley in Massachusetts, when there was a big attack by an indigenous tribe. And he supposedly appeared, this white bearded man supposedly appeared out of nowhere, organized like the local militia into repelling the attack, and then disappeared. He's known as the Angel of Hadley. And it's supposedly William Gough. And I just, and this is a slight security show. I realize this is not the year that I'd chosen, but let's go with 1675.
Okay.
When I was at university, I did a short internship with the Northern editor of The Guardian, a guy called Martin Wainwright, who's long since retired now. Fascinating guy from a long line of political campaigners and journalists. And we went to the opening of an exhibition at the Royal Armouries in Leeds, which hadn't been open for very long by that point. I think it had only been open like 1 or 2 years, and it was about the English Civil War and specifically the Regicides. And they had this big list. And I remember he was interviewing somebody, and I remember looking at this list and seeing this story. Like, that sounds amazing. Like, he went to America, and then there's like an attack, and I think that helped plant a seed in my brain that about 8 years later. When I decided I wanted to give reenactment a go, that there was already something planted there to go English Civil War.
Yeah.
You know, and that's incredible. But the reason why I probably choose 1642 is not necessarily because that's when war broke out. I wouldn't necessarily want to go and see one of the battles. But it's in, because that's when the crisis that had been essentially brewing since even before James the First of Scotland died. And one could say, you know, the English Civil War in one light is an expression of frustrations and compromises that had grown out of Elizabeth the First's reign. But there's that moment when Charles the First, egged on by his wife Queen Henrietta Maria, marches to Parliament with about 400 halberdiers, and tries to arrest 5 MPs and 1 member of the House of Lords. Edward Montagu, as kind of like the ringleaders of the main opposition to him. And they were tipped off and they'd fled. And there's that incredible moment where the king walks into the House of Commons, which is of itself a breach of the privilege of the House.
Yeah.
And sits down in the speaker's chair and can't see the people he wants to arrest, and so he's all, the birds have flown. And that's the moment at which the whole thing begins to fall apart. You know, within a very short space of time, he's fled London, And from that point on, it's only a matter of time until Charles loses the Civil War. Not that anything is truly inevitable, but without London in his pocket, it became very, very difficult for him to ever win that conflict. But to have been there in that moment of silence when everyone realizes what, you know, being in the room when it happened, you know, that line from Hamilton.
Yeah, it's the amazing scene in the film with Richard Burton and Alec Guinness as Cromwell and Charles I, respectively, where you think, like, okay, you've done a job of this, but also,
yeah,
imagine how much cooler but we as historical observers, imagine the impact it would have on you if you could see that. If you could just be a bloke at the back in a big hat, which you could because your kit is impeccable. You could just sit quite happily at the back and blend in and just watch that scene play out.
My main problem is that I'm 6'4", so I would stick out like a sore bloody thumb in the Houses of Parliament.
True. You'd have to put shoes on your knees, but, you know.
Yeah.
You can figure it out.
Yeah, it's one of those moments in history when something breaks.
Yeah.
And it's broken not by accident and not through some force of nature, but by the decisions that people have made. And for a long time, I guess what you'd call kind of Tory historians kind of saw it as something that almost happened by accident, and you know, Charles just did a bit of a boo-boo. But it represents a fundamental break with the past, and that for me is the most fascinating history, when something breaks. And Charles's decision to walk into the house armed,
yeah,
to arrest people in a conflict that was so much about people claiming to be representing or attempting to reestablish an ancient order of rights and privileges, when actually everyone's just innovating all over the shop. Like, even we tend to think in England of the House of Commons, of Parliament, as being this ancient institution, and really the House of Commons and the Lords as we have it now isn't really much more than 150 years old in its current form, and that's because of successive constitutional crises. As people have broken things, they've pushed in a certain direction and something has broken. And 1642 represents one of those moments when an awful lot of people who claim to be upholding ancient ways of life are all trying to gain some advantage by innovating, by changing things.
Yeah.
And that contrast between what they're saying and what they're doing is fascinating. We a few times I've been involved with an event in Huntingdon. It's organised by
cool.
Cromwell Museum.
Yeah, it's a great museum. It's a really cool, place.
It's amazing, and Stuart, who's the main guy there, he's absolutely fantastic bloke. He organises the trial of, like, a brief version of the trial of Charles I, and I play John Coke. I've completely forgotten his name now.
It's hard when you talk about
Don Cook.
Yeah, it's hard when you talk about 17th century characters, especially because there's no standardized spelling. So he might be John Cook in one reference, and then John Coke in another, and then John Cock in a third. You never know.
I always get confused because Edward Coke is like one of the I think maybe passed away by the time of the Civil War. He was like the great encoder of the English common law. A lot of what we consider to be like baseline legislation and law in England, especially, is because he decided to write it down. But there's a wonderful book called Yeah, there's a wonderful book called The Tyrannicide Brief by Jeffrey Robinson, who was a QC and a war crimes prosecutor.
Ooh, cool.
That basically lays out how the prosecution of Charles I in early 1649 laid the groundwork, again, a break with the past, laid the groundwork for prosecuting heads of state.
Oh, wow. Also, for anybody listening who's not aware, a QC, well, KC now, I suppose.
Yeah.
A Queen's Counsel or King's Counsel is basically a senior lawyer that kind of the monarch themselves gives the position to, as far as I'm aware, as a kind of wise old man of the law, basically.
Yes, yeah. QCs often become judges themselves, but the you can specialize as a KC, and his thing was war crimes prosecution. So he was involved in the prosecution of Slobodan Milosevic.
Oh wow!
For the Balkan War,
yeah,
and various others whose names escape me. But yeah, he talks about that being an exemplar, and that having been then used later. Much later, hundreds of years later, as precedent.
Wow.
When countries' leaders, such as we are finding right at the moment, declare themselves to be
above the law, effectively,
the kind of the embodiment of the will of the people, and all this authoritarian fascist crap, and so. It's one of the reasons why 17th century, and particularly the English Civil Wars, is so fascinating to me. And I was able to, when I was writing my book, I was able to actually draw on a lot of this history.
Nice.
For my understanding of politics and Joe's Dead, because also you have Thomas Hobbes, who writes Leviathan, which is an appeal to, an explanation of absolute dictatorship.
Yes.
You have the levelers and the diggers and the ranters and the Quakers and the Baptists who are all challenging this notion of absolute authority.
Yeah, they're wonderfully on the nose names. They've all got such wonderful on the nose names. I love it. Yeah,
all of them insults.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's brilliant. All this like Roundhouse, like Tory. It's all great.
There's a reason why we call them Tories.
Hey. Look it up, listeners.
But 1642, just that moment where he walks in, and you know, maybe even before, I'm blessed to be friends with Jonathan Healy, who's a fantastic historian who wrote a book called The Blazing World. And if you'll indulge me for a moment, in a second, I'll explain why that's fantastic. But he and I have talked about the fact that Lord Mandeville, Edward Montague, who go on to be the Earl of Manchester, whose regiment I reenact, was the only peer who was named with the five members to be arrested, and couldn't really work out why, particularly as there was a Privy Council meeting either the day before or that morning. And Mandeville's name was like scribbled in pencil in the margin of the list of names to be arrested, and that really is a want to be in the room when it happened moment of what did Mandeville say in that meeting that pissed Charles off so much, you know, or how did he remind Charles that actually he was probably a good person to have arrested. But yes, the slight diversion is the Blazing World was name of the first, one could argue, science fiction novel.
Oh, cool.
Which was a 1666 work by Margaret Cavendish, who was the Duchess of Newcastle. Now, the Earl of the Marquess of Newcastle funded the Northern Campaign. It was like in charge of the Northern Campaign for the King during the First Civil War. And The Blazing World is a kind of like a utopian thing about like a fantastical world where things are completely different, and there's how to describe it. Yeah, it is science fiction. It describes a fantastical world, a better world. Alan Moore, when he wrote The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, he entitled one of the books of that The Blazing World. And directly references Cavendish's writings as being part of this whole genre of speculative and imaginative and fantastical fiction that goes all the way through, you know, H.G. Wells, Rupert the Bear, you know, 2000 AD and superheroes, you know, which neatly brings all my interests together in one encapsulated little bow.
The ultimate nerd book.
Yeah. Awesome. But I do recommend Jonathan Healy's The Blazing World. It is very good. Awesome. And I'm looking forward to his next one as well.
Oh, I'll stick all the books mentioned I'll put in the description, because it's always nice to have more ideas for things for people to read. Yours will be at the top, obviously. Cool.
Thank you.
Going back to 1642, I love the idea of Charles trying to, you know, the whole all my birds have flown moment, where he tries to arrest the five in Parliament, and then him having to get back into his coach and just ride through London in chaos, like driving through basically Act One of Les Miserables, but in 17th century London, with like cannons being dragged and barricades being, but little old men like bringing halberds out that haven't been sharpened for 60 years, and just like, what's going on? Like, you sort of think about him in his coach to Hampton Court, going through West London, imagining it as it was then, with just fields and men in breeches, and just like, it must have just been, like, he must have been dissociating so hard. Because how can you imagine that happening to something as sort of solid in everybody's minds as the English monarchy? Just that turmoil suddenly just switched on.
Yeah.
Even with all of the stuff that had been happening for years previously, like the Bishop's Wars and the Scottish invasion and all the Elizabethan stuff. But then all of a sudden to be like, yeah, we're declaring war against London is declaring war against the king. Like, what? what?
And for so long, for certainly all of the first English Civil War, the parliamentarians, I'm reading a fantastic book by John Rees called Fiery Spirits, which is about the radicals in Parliament.
I've read that.
It's very, very, very
good. Really good.
And for most of the first English Civil War, the radicals were in a minority, so there were very few, and almost nobody, who you would regard as a Republican.
Yeah.
So even someone like Henry Martin, who goes on to be like one of the most rabid Republicans of the new regime, even he's not at that point yet. So quite often the cry, you know, the war cry of the parliamentarian armies was for king and parliament.
Yeah.
Because we want to put back is the true order of kings, lords, and commons, of you know, whatever church that we individually want, because it's the king's advisors. You know, we chopped off the Earl of Strafford's head. The Earl of Buckingham got murdered. William Lord had his the Archbishop of Canterbury had his head chopped off. So we just want to put back things back to how they were. But and coming back to that notion of what reality was and what people were saying, one of the reasons why the notion of the divine right of kings appears, and I know that there'll be historians who scream at me for this, kind of imposing a narrative, but one of the reasons why the divine right of kings appears as a notion and something that is propagated by states is because of the precariousness of monarchy.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it starts in England in particular, and it's partly to do with the rise of, well, the beginnings of a kind of English Protestant nationalism that is begun by Henry VIII, thanks to the break of Rome, and then fostered by his daughter Elizabeth, as a way of, you know, saying, actually, if you strike against me, it's a strike against God.
Yeah.
Regardless of your particular perspective, so whether you're Catholic or Protestant, you know, a Puritan or whoever, kings have a right to rule by God.
Yeah, divine right, isn't it?
Yeah, but that is, as with so many absolutes, it is not actually an expression of strength. It's an admission of weakness.
Yes, yes, and we can't.
And you can see it in Charles's reign, a little bit in James's reign, but particularly in Charles's reign. The more he gets challenged, the more people push back, the more absolutist he becomes. And again, I think that is a broad generalization. Well, and like the historian on my shoulder is screaming at me.
Well, no, but that's an effective.
I think that's an effective synopsis of an effective way of describing a man who felt he had a right to, if not, well, I think arguably a right to absolute power, or at the very least to not having his opinions questioned in the way that, and challenged in the way that they were, right? Like, I think, and this is me speculating on the psychology of a man who's been dead for 400 years, but 380 odd, but I think that a lot of what it is, I think a lot of that is him, like his reactions, and like you say, the more he gets backed into a corner, the more he kind of becomes an angry raccoon, is somebody saying, why isn't anyone listening to me? I am the king. I am my God-given right is to be an absolute ruler of men and have my will done. Why are these people doing this? Don't they understand? And I think there's a degree of him genuinely, like you said earlier, trying to do the right thing as he sees it. Because as far as he's concerned, the right thing is for him to be allowed to do the things he wants to do, like marching into Parliament, sitting in the Speaker's chair. People should have been cowed and immediately gone, oh, he's serious. We should toe the line again now and stop being so silly. Right?
Like, this is kind of where I give him his due, which is he was right to call out the innovations of those who opposed him. And the notion of parliamentary privilege was barely 60 years old, 70 years old, and very ill-defined. So technically he did nothing wrong marching in, not to defend him, because privilege did exist by that point.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So he was merely doing what he had been told by his father. Like, for those who don't know the Charles I history, he had an older brother. He was the second son.
Yeah.
He had an older brother called Henry, who died of smallpox at the age of 19 or 20, I think. And Henry, as you know, you can tell by his name, was raised to be a true Renaissance prince.
Yeah.
He was good at sports. He was good at hunting. He was intelligent. He was confident. And James, the First of England, James VI of Scotland, had written for him. You know, James's life had been marred by the murder of his parents, effectively. He wrote a book for Henry about how to be a good king.
Wow!
And in that, he talks about the divine right of kings.
Yeah.
And so imagine being the less confident, stammering, bandy-legged second son who had been destined probably a life in the church, really, or you know, married off to a foreign princess, as indeed he was with Henry, the French princess Henrietta Maria. And to be reading a book dedicated to your more popular older brother about how to be a kid, like you would absorb all of that. And what I find fascinating, there's a really good podcast, very long podcast, called Early Modern England, which goes all the way from the death of Elizabeth all the way through to the end, to the Restoration in 1660.
Cool.
And it's absolutely fantastic. It's like 200 episodes or something.
Oh, awesome. Yeah,
and
I like that.
My third re-listen. It's amazing. one of the things that really strikes me about that is the number of times when Charles would be traveling through the country at various points, both before and during the Civil War, and people will cheer. And he convinces himself repeatedly that that's about him, that they're cheering him personally, that actually the kingdom, the people are behind him. It's just all these fiery spirits who are just getting in the way. And all he needs to do is call on the people and they'll rise up against these. And they weren't. What they were doing was either cheering the notion of the monarchy as the settled order, or cheering the prospect of peace.
Yeah. That's really sad when you think about it like that.
And he, one of his failings, I think, as a complete amateur, is that he confused victory with peace.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was a very kind of 1914 spirit, 1640, wasn't there, with a kind of, right, well, I'll just capture Hull, and then everyone will go, oh, he's captured Hull. And again, stop being so silly. I'm the king. You love me because I'm the king.
If I just do this one thing, they will crumble.
And it will crumble. And it's interesting because we had Chelsea Rutke from the University of Utah was talking about how these things are... It's sort of history repeats itself, or rhyming, as Tennessee Williams said, I think. History doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. But again, figures, authoritarian figures especially, and in particular authoritarian figures who failed earlier in life, when they do get into a position of power, will think this is destiny manifesting itself for me. Everybody's going to love me now. I'm going to do a couple of things and everyone will surge behind me and support me. And they don't. It just doesn't happen for them. But it's something that happens again and again and again. And it's interesting to think about kind of, like we were saying, we're sort of speculating on somebody's personality centuries after. But yeah, he was a stammering, bandy-legged second son whose big brother got a book dedicated to him. And you think, well, yeah, of course he wanted everyone to love him. Of course he then... At last, it's my turn. At last, you know, it's...
I can't remember which book it is. But there was was it Kevin Sharp's book? I may be assigning him ideas that he didn't espouse. But one of the benefits of sort of revisionist history over the last 50 years is to psychologically analyze somebody like Charles I. And he was thin-skinned and he was prickly and he was formal almost to not liking the presence of other people. But when he made a friend, he stuck with them through thick and thin, to the point where it interfered with his own judgment about things.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's an expression of a very lonely child who didn't have many friends, who took everything very personally. And you then thrust them into a situation where everybody is just constantly having a go and you take it personally. And, you know, you make the Duke of Buckingham is a perfect example. So many of the ills that Parliament wished to correct in the state were because power was invested in Charles's best friend, who had been his father's best friend and probable lover. And then Buckingham is 1629, I think. Buckingham is assassinated. And Charles loses that part of himself. He loses that friend who was terrible. at this historical moment when we're talking about basically the incompetence being in charge, and aren't they making a mess of everything because they're incompetent? Perfect example. And on a personal level, I feel sorry for Charles the First because he was not the man for the moment, and you could argue that no one could have stood up. If his brother had survived and become Henry the Ninth, would actually have he been able to contain these fiery spirits?
Yeah, would they? Yeah, what would have done? What would his politics and diplomacy have done in the same situation? And how would it have affected?
Yeah.
Would there have been civil war? Would it have been as extreme? Would it have been worse? I love a bit of speculative. I love a bit of what ifing. A bit of speculative history is always fun.
What if George Monk hadn't been captured at the Battle of Nantwich in 1644? What if Oliver Cromwell had emigrated to the colonies like he was thinking about doing in the 1620s? What if John Pym hadn't died of? I mean, this is great white man, dead white man history. But what if John Pym hadn't died of cancer in 43, 44? Like I said at the beginning, these are all choices. History is a series of choices made by people who don't know the whole picture at any given moment.
Yeah.
And so for us, history really is about analyzing those choices in the context they were made and the people who were making them, but not letting people off the hook.
That's key, I think. And I like that you brought up revisionist history as well, just as a school of historical academic thought, because it is just taking the received wisdom of and going, okay, but he was a baddie though. So I think it gives us I think it's important to keep a rounded view of, like, Charles the First did a lot of things wrong, but he had an awful lot of these probable psychological issues, and his upbringing in many ways sucked. There's always nuance to a situation. That's why I keep banging on about it on my YouTube channel. Nuance is because we as reenactors are in a place where we often encounter the public's view of history as presented to them in schools, which is, oh yeah, roundheads versus cavaliers, Puritans versus papists. And you can kind of go, well, no. And I think that's actually something quite important that we, in our silly little hobby where we dress in itchy woolen clothes and drink beer in fields, do a bit of public outreach there. I think that's an important thing that we can do, if we choose to do it, if we choose to be the sort of, the nerds that we are, which I'm very glad that we are. But if we choose to do that, I think it can become a very powerful tool for public education. So, I'm all for encouraging the reassessment of historical figures and big pivotal moments of history with sort of the full weight and ammunition of history available to us now, because it's all out there. We can do a lot of it without paying money for it, which is nice.
I think the mistake an awful lot of people who rail against revisionism misunderstand is that history is not a series of settled facts.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is stories that we tell from different perspectives. I just read a two separate biographies of Henrietta Maria, Charles I's wife, one by Leander de Lisle and the other by Alison Plowden. And they take very different perspectives on the whole thing and have very different styles. And de Lisle's book I really enjoy because there's I'm researching a particular individual. There was details in that weren't available to Plowden when she was writing. But you know, the way she tells the story is absolutely fascinating, and you can enjoy a perspective on historical character without necessarily agreeing with with that perspective.
That's a great way
and
to put
I don't
it,
agree
yeah.
with Bilal's perspective, but I value the research and the way she puts together the information, because it's an alternative perspective. And the most important thing, though, I think, is what I said about not letting people off the hook, even though things are different perspectives, even though you can't know everything, even though, you know, some things of the time are different to how they are now. That does not absolve people. We are not Pope. We are not the Pope or God.
No, and the Pope's not well.
Well, exactly. For me, the 17th century is a perfect exemplar of all of that, because for so long people were like, yep, this is what happened. Like that, Edward Hyde's The Great Rebellion, which was written by Charles I's advisor, the Earl of Clarendon, and then S.R. Gardner, who was the great Victorian historian who wrote, you know, his multi-volume work. And then from the public's perspective, that was kind of it.
Yeah. In fact, I remember one of my family friends had a copy of Gardner's book on their bookshelf and said, oh, this is the book you want to read, when I expressed an interest in the English Civil Wars. And I thought, no, not sure it is. Not the only book I want to read, but it's fascinating that just received wisdom.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop.
But then you get, and then Christopher Hill comes along in the 1960s. And I've just read a fantastic biography by Michael Braddock about Christopher Hill, who was a radical historian. He was a communist, though that's another story in of itself. And he was a Marxist. He was a Marxist historian, and Marxist analysis of the English Civil War period completely changed people's understanding. So, you know, one of the things that I found most fascinating about Braddock's book was that from a if you ask historians about Hill's work, they'll go, well, that's kind of old hat now. You know, the Marxists had their moment in the 60s and 70s, and it's completely, we've had multiple waves of revisionism since then and blowback and everything. And I go, yes, but from the public's point of view, if I go to a Sealed Knot event and I talk to people about the Civil War, which happens less than you might think in an English Civil War reenactment society.
It's not, it's normally, is that real fire stuff, isn't it, a lot of the time?
Oh, I mean, but even our members, I always tell the story that one of our musket officers in my regiment didn't even know what side she was on until her third battle.
That's incredible.
It's brilliant, because people join for all sorts of reasons,
mostly the
social side. So we have closeted royalists in our Presbyterian regiment. But anyway, you know, if I talk to a fellow member about the English Civil War, quite often the books they will have read are S.R. Gardner and Christopher Hill.
Wow.
So, yes, you know, from the point of view of actual academia, of history, as a growing, evolving discipline, Hill's perspective, there's a lot of holes in it. You know, he was selective with his evidence, blah, 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 blah. But my God, he could tell a great story about ordinary people.
And that's key, is if a narrative sticks, it becomes the way people think about events. If you read things like, I'm reading a couple of conspiracy theory books at the minute, if you read The Holy Blood and The Holy Grail and don't criticize it, if you don't look at the footnotes and the citations and see how most of them are made up or wrong, it's a hell of a compelling read. And it's a real page turner. If you take it as a piece of historical work, it's garbage. But if you look at it just as a romp, you can see how people believe the hype about Templars and the Holy Grail really, really easily. And it's, yeah, it's fascinating how long those narratives stick in the public's consciousness, right? Like, it's incredible that Hill and Gardner are still the people. Like, we're still talking about them now. We're talking about them in 2025 as being relevant to the public's knowledge of the Civil Wars. When I think one of the things that we should probably be looking into is dismantling the ivory towers that means that there's that disconnect between current academic research and what the public think. I've been to conferences where we've had reenactors and we've had, you know, public historians and people like me who do silly little videos on the internet having a round table with academics at universities who have said, oh, do you think that the public would be interested in this sort of stuff? When I'm at a conference about historical clothing from the medieval period. Like, no duh. Like, have you not been on the internet recently? It's just fascinating that there's that disconnect. And it's sad that there's that disconnect, but yeah, like, this is...
I mean, I would argue that the disconnect is... I saw someone having a go at a historian on Blue Sky recently talking about ivory towers. And the historian quite rightly pointed out that the public history as a concept is now more prevalent than it's ever been. Like, yeah. Hill was doing like radio shows in the 1970s, and like teachers' guides and things like that. That now would seem incredibly esoteric, but if you look at the sheer number just on social media of history accounts, there are so many historians who are coming through who are talking direct to the public. The difficulty is that so much of what they are relating has to come from that deep nerdy ivory tower academia, because otherwise that's the engine that is bringing all these things to light.
Yeah,
you know, as you will know from the Viking stuff, like the understanding of the notion of a Viking has fundamentally changed over the last 50 years, even in the last 20 years.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Absolutely. It's, yeah. And it's just, I find it really interesting trying to pick at where these things change, to try and pick apart to find the disconnect, where the disconnect happens. And I think you've touched on it earlier where you talked about reenactorisms, which is, you know, the sealed knot has been going for longer than the English Civil Wars went on now. It's like...
Oh, much, much longer. It's
longer.
Over 50 years now.
Yeah, it's 50 years old. It's like MASH that went on for so much longer than the Korean War that they were having to make things up at various points about things.
Well,
I've
fought the Battle of Naseby 5 times.
And lived to tell the tale, right? So anyone that you fight is a... Anyone you survive is a victory. But yeah, like... It's interesting to see where the disconnect comes from, and I think reenactorisms are one of those things where people will say things like, you know, the founder of the SEAL, Brigadier Peter Young, was a historian, but he was an amateur historian in the 1960s and 70s. And history has moved on a lot since then. Like you say, we've had multiple waves of revisionism and feminist history and post-feminist history and all of the other sort of bits of it. But people will still say, when questioned, where does this come from? Or where did you learn that? I was like, oh, the Brig said it in the 1978 or whatever. Or, you know, oh, this is just how we do it in our regiment. You're like, okay, but is it how people would have done it in the 1640s? Is that how that fashion choice that you've made in 2025, would that have been seen in the same way? Would people think that two different colours of, you know, to make it really small scale stuff, would they think different colours of hose worn at the same time was cool? Or would they think that you looked like a jester? You know, is your bosom pushed up and in that way fashionable, or is it scandalous? And are you trying to do one or the other of those now? Or is this just, oh, well, this is what corsets look like, right? Not that they would be wearing corsets. I know. No, don't at me. But I know they're wearing bodies. Don't at me. But it's just interesting to kind of try and pick away at that disconnect and go, right, you haven't got this from that academic engine. You've got that from just the way my mates do it. Or you've got it from an Osprey book or Perry Miniatures or whatever. It's interesting to where the tertiary sources are.
So much of it is also particularly because of your reenacting battles. Military history has its own eddies and tides and desires. It's with the civil wars in particular, and it's the same with the Vikings. The Victorians are to blame. In fact, most of the ills of the world are the faults of the Victorian English, and specifically. Because the Victorians told themselves stories that placed them as the heroes of history. And so, and this is a big consequence of Whig history, so WHIG history, which saw history as an inevitable and steady movement towards progressiveness and freedom and all this, that and the other. And the Victorians in particular were absolute buggers for crafting stories in which they could see themselves.
When we say Whigs, for anyone who isn't familiar, the Whigs were effectively the precursor to the Liberal Party in the UK, as opposed to the Tories. But they were buggers.
Kind of anti-monarchical... I mean, not even that, really. Just radicals, I guess, for want of a better phrase.
Just not, and by 19th century terms as well, sort of radical, but by our modern standards, kind of sort of limply not as conservative as the conservatives of the 19th century. They liked people to have human rights and that sort of thing. They thought black people were people, for the most part. They, you know...
And this is the thing that even in moments when there were radical movements, there was incredible pushback from Victorian society because so much of it was, and this is what we suffer from in the past now very acutely, and have done for my entire lifetime, is seeing the victories of the past as inevitable.
Yeah. Yes.
So exactly. overcoming slavery, the civil rights movements, the suffragettes,
the victories, the parliamentarian victories in the civil wars.
Yeah. These were things are safely in the past. Yes, they were radical. Isn't it amazing? And then you get movements now, and this has been the same all through history. You get radical movements now that are just fought against so hard. You know, we only have to look at what's happened. One of the things that inspired me to write my book was the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, which weren't even the first Black Lives Matter protests. You see the backlash against even just being asked to not be shit.
Yeah. Be nice to people who aren't the same color as you is an incredibly difficult ask for some people. Yeah,
and you bring up Black Lives Matter with certain sections of society and be like, oh yeah, no, it ruined the crime waves. It was all crime waves. Like, nobody defunded the police.
Yeah,
and even on the occasions when it did happen, it was a huge success. But you radicalism. I mean, there's that horrible old phrase, which is eventually everyone will have been against this.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the dangerous revisionism.
Yeah.
Not looking at the past anew, not finding new perspectives, not correcting misnomers or reenactorisms or anything like that. It is the people who look to history and cannot see the lessons that it teaches us.
Yeah. The definition I was given, Dr. Phil Freeman, who was one of my lecturers at Liverpool, he described revisionism as taking the received wisdom of the past, received wisdom of history, and challenging it with new information. And I think as people who study history, that's the best thing we can do, is always challenge things and never accept if somebody gives you that, well, of course, that sort of almost manifest destiny point of view on history, challenge it, because like you say, you know, systems of power are incredibly they're very, very solid until they're not. Until the straw breaks the camel's back. You know, until Charles marches into Parliament and the birds have flown, oh shit moment. You know, until the oh shit moment, it's all rock solid, baby, and then
yeah.
You know, American democracy is rock solid until it isn't.
Yeah, and you know, coming back to what we said at the beginning, which is that these are all choices. Absolutely. Institutions persist because people choose to abide by the rules of those institutions.
Yeah.
As soon as somebody stops doing that, no laws in the world, no rules, no conventions, no precedent is going to stop them.
Yep.
So if your international order, is based on everybody just playing by the rules because they want to, then you're going to end up with fascism, because all it takes is for bad actors to start influencing that process. I'm going to have to go because my wife is coming back from her exercise classes. She's going to be angry that I've not cooked tea.
Well, you must go and cook tea.
Do not put that in your podcast.
I need to go and cook tea as well, and I'm absolutely not going to put it in the podcast, I promise. Look to camera. I think there are some wonderful takeaways from this, because we've done that thing that you said that we always do at reenactments, which is true, which is very briefly talked about the English Civil War and then talked about absolutely everything else. Because we went,
everything comes back to the English Civil War.
Everything. It is the emerald tablet of history from the 17th. It is the greater and the lesser, as above, so below. Yeah, but we could go back to the English Civil War and talk about the sources of this. I'm willing to subscribe to that theory. Brilliant. All right. Well, in that case, I'll do a little. I'll do the thing that I say, which is, have you got anything to plug at the moment? And I feel like you've got at least a book and a podcast to plug. So,
yeah,
we have mentioned them. So you've got the 2080 Thrillcast.
Hang on.
Oh, for the benefit of the listener, Mike has fled the room.
All right, I've been on Judy's podcast.
Oh, it's because Mrs. Mike is home. Don't worry.
No, I will do it. Sorry, I've been.
It's my fault. Tell her it's my fault. Tell her it's my fault. It's my fault. I'll zoom off. It's my fault.
Let's just do this bit.
Yeah, let's do this bit. So you've got the 2008 Thrillcast that you present, and how often does it come out?
Yeah. It's now weekly. So there's the weekly show, which is In Orbit every Wednesday, which is me and my friend Chloe Maviel. And there is the monthly creator tapes, which is an in-depth interview with a 2080 creator. And then my colleague Steve Morris does a monthly deep dive.
Awesome. I love the deep dives. The deep dives on the creator post are great.
Yeah.
They're so good.
So that keeps me on my toes.
I bet it does. Amazing. And I will put a link in the description to I Am the Law, How Judge Dredd Predicted Our Future, which is an awesome read. A genuinely great read. Brilliant. Mike, thank you so much. You are in trouble if you don't read, if you don't leave the recording soon, so I will let you go. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's always a pleasure, and it's weird to see you in 21st century clothing.
Well, I will see you in a muddy field somewhere, dressed entirely in wool soon.
Yay! All right, that is me stopping recording. Thank you so much to everybody for listening to this episode of Steeped in History. I really hope you've enjoyed this conversation with the fantastic, multi-talented, incredibly knowledgeable and insightful Michael Mulcher, a man I am proud to call my friend and a fellow reenactor. Thank you ever so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. Thank you to all of my lovely patrons, to everybody who is financially supporting the podcast and the channel. If you would like to support the channel financially or the podcast, you can, of course, go to the Patreon link. And yeah, until the next time, Tana Tro Nissa, Hwylfawr am y tro, bye-bye for now, a diolch am wranto. Thank you for listening. Steeped in History is produced by Jimmy Johnson. It is edited by Jimmy Johnson. It is presented by Jimmy Johnson. Basically, I did most of this. However, it does feature music from Ina Ban, and our lovely artwork was made by Anika Benson. And that's pretty much it. Oh, we're also hosted on the Audio Boom Network. There we go. There's always more to these, isn't there, at the end? They're getting longer and longer.